It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcasts.com. I hope you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with your friends if you like it. Today, I have an interview for you with Douglas Murray. He is the author of 7 books, including The Madness of Crowds and The Strange Death of Europe. His latest book is The War on the West. It details the real push on the part of the left to take down a Western civilization in so many different ways, eradicating the post-Enlightenment lessons that we have used to great effect in the West for such a long time, and to undermine everything that America and Europe has achieved in so many different ways. The book's a fascinating read, and our conversation delves into a lot of different areas. Doug Murray is one of the smartest writers out there today, and I appreciated him taking the time to sit down with me. Douglas Murray, coming up next.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Douglas Murray, thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Ben.
I want to talk to you about your book, The War on the West. But before I do, it seems to me that you've been telling a story across the past couple of books that you've written. There's some threads and through lines that appear in all of them. And I wonder if, as you've been writing this series of books, which includes Strange Death of Europe and Madness of Crowds, which I'm sure our listeners are familiar with. What are some of the changes that you've perceived in the West in terms of the conflicts that are going on within it? How is it different now than when you began writing this series of books?
Well, The Strange Death of Europe was about the challenge of migration in the 21st century. And I said in that book that we just weren't thinking about it in any country in the West nearly seriously enough, you know, and that although the developed world is very attractive to the developing world cannot move to the developed world unhindered. You know, we have to have immigration policies, we have to have borders, and that our politicians are sort of fibbing basically around the edges of that. They weren't being honest with the publics about the scale of the challenge. And the other part of that book, which perhaps was more controversial, was the point that societies are also changed by the people who are in them. Mm-hmm. You know, that immigration isn't just about numbers coming across a border, but what the country is like as those borders become more fluid. And the next book I wrote, The Madness of Crowds, was about some of the attempts, as I see it, to basically rewrite the stories of countries like America or countries like my own country of birth, Great Britain, partly because the story we had sort of become inadequate in the eyes of many of our politicians and media. You know, so they wanted a new story to come in. And as I said in The Madness of Crowds, the sort of new story of Western democracies was, we had to talk endlessly about minority rights and non-minority rights, you know, women's rights. We had to exaggerate the extent of any remaining misogyny in society. We had to talk about feminism. We had to talk about homophobia as if it had never been worse at a point when it had never been less of it. We had to talk about race all the time and racial groupings. And basically, as I said, there was an attempt to get a new story, which was, instead of the story of, say, America, we had the story of civil rights, we had the story of human rights and rights acquisitions. And then, you know, as I was writing that book and The Strange Death of Europe, I realized that actually underneath all of these things and much more, there was a common thread going on in our time, which was just this attempt to basically rid ourselves of everything that had been ours. Now, of course, this thought had been in my mind for a long time, but it wasn't really until the summer of 2020 that it just solidified and absolutely came into plain sight. For me, the moment when everyone was basically isolated, where people had been locked in their houses and moved from being told that the corona pandemic meant that no one should meet their loved ones, to actually the more important pandemic is racism and you must all go onto the streets and demonstrate and indeed burn stuff down if you like. Everything came into an incredibly clear focus for me. And that focus was that basically there was a hatred of the West going on that had become permissible. The only bigotry that had become permissible was bigotry towards white people for the color of their skin. Quite rightly, we've got rid of any tolerance for any other type of racism, except for this racism against the people who still form the majority of people in countries like America and Britain. And then there was just the very clear war on our history. You know, literally seeing statues pulled down by mobs or preemptively pulled down by local authorities, and seeing every figure of the American past and indeed the Western past put through this. All of this made me realize this is a period like periods of iconoclasm in history, where a new story is being forced upon us and we're being asked to submit to it because the story is changing. Now, that's something that I picked up on in previous books I dwelt on, but it's never been clearer than it is now, that we are dealing with a fundamental attempt to reboot our societies and to claim that the society should be something other than it is.
Historically, the most successful political progressives, in terms of movements or in terms of leaders, have been those that essentially say, the West is a good place and we would like to be fully part of it. This is Martin Luther King's message. This is the message, I would argue, of the gay rights movement in large part. It's saying the Boy Scouts are a good thing. We would like to be part of it. Marriage is a good thing. We would like to be part of it. Or in the case of King, you know, America, society, you know, we are coming here for the note that we were promised.
Yes.
And in other words, it does not function as a rejection of the West, but rather a call for inclusion within it.
Absolutely.
And what changed?
Right. What changed was the radicals won on the left. They got a dominance in the argument, and they then used the lowest tools to attack the right. What I mean by that is, you know, that, for instance, they proved themselves willing to use the most appalling lies. They decided that it was possible to just lie about American history, that it was possible to say that anyone who stood in their way was a racist or a misogynist and a homophobe as well, if they cared to add that, but mainly racist. And they were using the lowest tools that they knew would wound. And as you say, Ben, that the successful rights movements didn't do this. You know, the people on the fringes of the gay rights movement who said we want to tear down the society were not successful. The fringes in the feminist movement who said from the 1920s, when we were talking just about having the equal rights to vote, if suffragettes and others had said, and that's why we want a total revolution and the pulling down of the capitalist system and there's nothing good about the country, you know, women might not have the vote. I mean, it's a very bad strategy unless you are actually a revolutionary. And there is this movement, which I described in The Madness of Crowds as well, where it seems that some people think that the answer to past prejudice is present day prejudice, that the answer to any past discrimination is to rectify it with present day discrimination. And this is not my interpretation. This is the words of the people who I expose in the book. People like the man who calls himself Ibram X. Kendi, who wrote this book called How to Be an Anti-Racist, which, as I always say, should just lose the term anti from the title and it would be correct. Ibram X. Kendi says in his book the answer to past discrimination is present discrimination, that effectively because blacks were discriminated against in the past, white people must now be discriminated against in the present. And of course, as I say, this is not really about justice. This, at that stage, is about revenge.
Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is such an important distinction, because it flows through many of the debates that come, not just about our culture war issues, but about economic issues as well. Mm. Is this an act of vengeance, or is this an act of justice? And I just want to connect this back to, you know, kind of the conversation about the relationship between, you know, business and the American people. And Ross Douthat was responding to something I had written last week in the New York Times, and he sort of drew a through line from something I was saying to something Elizabeth Warren had said back in the day about, you know, when you had a business, you didn't just, she didn't use the language, you didn't build that by yourself, but she used the idea of, you know, you have an obligation to the community to give back in certain ways, et cetera. How do we determine the difference between policy as an act of vengeance and policy as an act of justice? Because it seems to me much of the progressive policy today, their approach to policy today, is meant to muddle all that into the same thing.
Well, one thing is, you can tell, you know, the way I often think of it is in the same way we might interpret this in our personal lives. If somebody said to you, you know, Ben, there's nothing good about you, nothing. You know, I don't like the way you look. I don't like your clothes. I don't like your accent. I don't like your friends. I don't like your family.
I the greatest of sinners.
if somebody did that to you, then you, as if they did it to me, would say, I'm not really dealing with a friendly critic here. I'm dealing with somebody who really, really doesn't like me. And therefore, I probably shouldn't listen to them for, I don't know, ideas, fine-tuning, or wardrobe advice, or anything else. This person doesn't like me. That's just, you know, it's the same thing in politics. It's the same thing in culture. When people say that America has done nothing good, they're not trying to fine tune the American dream. They're trying to end it. When people say America has nothing good that it has done in its history and everything in its past is bad, you're not dealing with a critic. You're dealing with an opponent. And, you know, we see this in things like the 1619 Project, which I tear apart in the early part of the book. Yes. You know, the 1619 Project, people, I think, have to realize, is not just the paper that used to be known as the paper of record in the United States, taking it upon itself to rewrite the founding date of America so that the date, so that the history of America is founded in sin. That's explicitly what they want to do. It's not just that. As they showed in their opening project and their opening essays, they want to use this as a cultural battering ram. The 1619 Project commissioned as one of its first works an incredibly inept article, which I tear into in my book, in The War on the West. They published this incredibly inept article by somebody claiming that capitalism itself was derived from plantations. Now, first of all, it's flat out historical. First of all, no. Secondly, also no. Thirdly, the inept figure in question who wrote this piece tried to claim that he had sources to back it up, and the only source he had was a scholar who said, actually, there's no evidence for this, so he can't even read what he refers to. But put that aside for a second. Of course, the system on plantations was not capitalism, which must therefore bear the brunt of all the sins of slavery. The system on plantations was feudalism. It was absolutely an aping of the old feudalist system. It has nothing to do with free market economics. It has nothing to do with capitalism. It was a sin that was common across centuries in many other feudal societies. But the 1619 Project in the New York Times didn't want to acknowledge that. They wanted to use this newly resurfaced sin, this new return to the original sin, as a means to take out everything they don't like in the present day. You know, they happen to not like capitalism. bam, let's commission somebody to write a piece claiming that capitalism is also from slavery. I mean, this isn't legitimate criticism of extremes of the free market. It's not a critique of people where capitalism goes wrong, which goodness knows it can, like everything else. It's just a straightforward run at it by an ideological enemy using the tool of the time.
I attended an event at American University several years ago, 2018, where that was my first personal exposure to Ibram X. Kendi. And so I feel a little bit like a hipster in this anti-racist stuff, because I was shocked. It was mostly meant to be a book selling operation, but I attended it and I was amazed at the, you know, just how packed everything was. And DeRay was there, and you had all of these different commentators coming in. And it was basically the 1619 Project before it existed. It was just, that was what you were hearing from the main stage. And it was striking to me to see so many people in these rooms and seem to be just enraptured by what they were hearing, which I thought was utterly bonkers. You write in War on the West that this is, you know, a message that's being a war that's being carried out across the media and airwaves and throughout the education system from as early as preschool. And I think that was my first inkling that, oh, these aren't just books for guilty, wealthy white people who would like to be told how awful and racist they are, alongside, you know, those dinners that you made reference to. That woman holds it was something that seemed to be much more seeping through, intentionally directed at trying to change our culture. Tell me about what is behind that, because it's not just, you know, the elites who are thumb sucking and doing this. It is much more intentional than that. What is behind
It is much more intentional than that. One way you can see what's behind it, or at least behind a part of it, is seeing who they don't critique, who they don't attack. You know, I say in the history section of the book, as you know, I say, look, you know, it seemed very strange to me that Winston Churchill should become such a subject of hatred by the new cultural revolutionaries. You know, why select Winston Churchill for a particular attack to the extent that his statue in Parliament Square in London has to be covered up by an iron box to protect him from the mob? Why go for Winston Churchill? Why go for the national hero in Britain and an international hero in the West? Why in America go for the founding fathers? Why go for Thomas Jefferson? The city I'm currently sitting in New York, the council chamber just last year voted to remove the statue of Thomas Jefferson. They did remove it. They crated him up, winched him down, and carted him out of the back door where his statue had been in since the 1830s. And as he was wheeled out, one of the council members said, "Thomas Jefferson no longer represents our values." Why go for the founding fathers? Why go for not just the South side in the Civil War, but the North as well? Why go for Abraham Lincoln? And the answer I kept coming back to was because these cultural revolutionaries want to strip us of all of our heroes. They want to do what revolutionaries have done throughout history. They want to go into our holy places. They want to destroy them. They want to ransack them. They want to pull down the statues. They want to destroy the images. And they want to do it and then say, you have no gods, you have no one to admire, you will have to accept what we are giving you as new gods. Now, as I say in the War on the West, of course, much of this is not new at all. It's very, very old. One of the figures that historically gets none of this treatment is Karl Marx. You know, Thomas Jefferson, everybody else who's been attacked in recent years, all of the Enlightenment thinkers, have all been attacked for living in a time in which slavery or colonialism were going on, or are attacked because they once said something, but by the standards of 2022, we regard as racist. Who does this treatment not get applied to? Karl Marx. Mm-hmm. Karl Marx, as I show in the book, was by any modern standards an extraordinarily virulent racist. Even by the standards of his time, he was a very virulent racist. He constantly uses the N-word in an entirely negative way, and he hyphenates it to the word Jew, and he just uses every racial epithet he can in his private and in his public writings. He's got horrible views on slavery, horrible views on colonialism. So why hasn't he been given this treatment that everyone else has been given? It's because the radicals who would like to pull everything down know that they still have some people they'd like to put in their place. And as I say in the book, this is actually quite common. In the post-colonial period, in Africa and elsewhere, it was very striking that the post-colonial people, the people who wanted to lead the revolutions after the end of the colonial era, repeatedly said that the answer after the Western powers withdrew was Marxism. And that, on the face of it, seems absurd, of course, doesn't it? Because it would make a certain logic if you said, say, when the French removed themselves from Algeria, to say, well, now the French have gone, we are going to be able to return to a pre-French Algerian culture and engage in our lives as it were as they were before the French arrived. That would make a certain sense. What makes no sense on their own terms is to say, now that the Western colonialists have gone, we can embrace Western Marxism. So there's a fallacy there, but it works throughout the era. Now, here's just one other very quick follow-on point, because obviously not everybody involved in the current Cultural Revolution is a Marxist. Obviously, there are also people who have been, among much else, deluded into believing the picture they have been given of modern-day America and the modern-day West. I'm thinking of people in their late teens and early 20s, people who think that America is the country they are told that it is. People who, as I say in a section of the book about the campus moral panics across America, not just one or two examples, but multiple examples in the last decade, of students on American campuses, like citing members of the KKK, the campuses going into lockdown until everyone is safe, and realizing these are figments of the student's imagination. You know, on one occasion, campus goes into lockdown because a single member of the KKK has been seen allegedly walking around campus carrying a whip. It turns out that the person in question, poor man, is a Dominican monk carrying a rosary.
I loved that. I had totally forgotten about that story, and I loved that bit.
I mean, those, and I give these other examples. I mean, campuses that go into lockdown because a pair of shoelaces that somebody has found have been hung up on a hook, and somebody claims it's an attempted lynching. These things suggest that there is a type of young American, young Westerner, who actually believes that they live in a society where the KKK wander around campus, sometimes alone, sometimes all together, where there are lynchings all the time, where there are attempted lynchings all the time. The sort of people who immediately fell for the Jussie Smollett hoax and, you know, thought that it was actually likely that, you know, in the early hours of the morning in Chicago, a couple of Trump-supporting, red cap-wearing MAGA people would say this is MAGA country. My point is that the country has been lied to about itself, and a new generation appears to be falling for the lie. And they mustn't, because it is such an outrageous lie that is being told about America and about the wider West.
We'll have more of my conversation with Douglas Murray right after this. Those roving bands of MAGA youths.
That's right.
My sister texted me yesterday a picture of one of these little libraries that someone has in front of their house. And on the side of it, it reads, "Fill me up with authors who are of color, neurodiverse, differing abilities, LGBTQ. So I responded, well, I would just bring Frederick Douglass, Thomas Sowell, Leon Hersey Ali, Camille Paglia, and Deirdre McCloskey, and probably Clarence Thomas's autobiography, too. but see, this is the thing, Douglass, that they're using these elements now to drive out the quote-unquote old white men, the old dead white men, who still offend us because despite not being, you know, walking around anymore. when you talk about someone like Thomas Jefferson, obviously he's someone who is, you know, full of conflicts, but is one of the most important Americans who ever lived.
Yes.
How can we restore something that used to be at the center of American life? Think about this for a moment. We had Jefferson-Jackson dinners among the Democratic Party for decade upon decade upon decade, gathering to fundraise, you know, citing two of their greatest presidents, or the greatest presidents they would claim, but they do not claim them anymore.
Yes. Well, this is a big problem, because you cannot unify a country or a culture if you are totally divided on the nature of what you have been. You know, any people who've fallen out, as it's undoubtedly the case in America, the political sides have very rapidly, must find things they agree on. Now, I would say that there are two big things in the 20th century, for instance, that Americans agreed on. One was that they had been a force for good in the world, particularly in intervening in the Second World War. And that in helping to win the Second World War, America was able to live off that, the virtue, and Jonathan Haidt and others have written about this, were able to live off the virtuous, you know, fumes of that success. And that was good. That was absolutely right. America had something to be deeply proud of, because she had sent her sons across the world to fight for freedom. And this was something about which Americans could be very, very proud. And only people on the very furthest fringes of American politics thought that it wasn't something to be proud of. Mm-hmm. The second bit of, as it were, moral fume that the Americans were able to live off was the civil rights movement, was the recognition that that there had been a largely peaceful, almost entirely peaceful reckoning with a historic injustice. And the civil rights movement was the apex of this, led by extraordinary people who were American, who helped to rectify a terrible wrong at home. And that this had not been rectified as other countries have rectified their problems by mass violence and so on, but had been litigated politically and morally. Mm-hmm. This was something which, and you can see that this united people, because until very recently, as I always say, when Dr. Martin Luther King's moral vision was completely inverted, until recently, everybody still wanted a piece of that action. Mm-hmm. We still admired people in the West who had been involved in civil rights struggles. We admired the people who had patriotically and decently course-corrected their nation. So much so that, as I say, you know, long after that battle had been won, people still wanted to have a part of it. Now, I would argue, even that is exhausted, as the moral victory abroad in the 20th century is exhausted. Mm. And Americans can't agree even on that recent past. So, of course, they can't agree on the 19th century or about the founding fathers, let alone when there are active activists in the country trying to warp the history, like the 1619 Project, like Ibram X. Kendi, like Robin DiAngelo, people who lie about American history, and I catch them out on the lies again and again. These are people deliberately trying to tear America apart. And the way to try to rectify that is to try to do the opposite and to try to find things that are agreed upon. For instance, yes, the founding fathers lived in a time of slavery, and some of them were involved in slavery. Well, at that time, everybody in the world was involved in slavery to some extent. You know, every civilization in the world had slavery. The thing that was remarkable about the West was that the West was the civilization that abolished slavery itself and then sought to abolish it everywhere else as well. Now, that would seem to me to be a perfectly plausible and indeed admirable position, as well as a truthful one, about the American past. If Americans could just agree on things like that, you know, that it was a good, I mean, one of my other bugbears about this is the rewriting of the Columbus story, which has obviously gone on for many years now. but, you know, agree that it was a good thing that Columbus discovered the Americas. It was a good thing that the Americas are as they are. You know, we're not.
Talking. That's really testy talk right there, Douglas.
It's a good thing. I'm glad that he didn't. I'm glad he didn't take a wrong turning. I'm glad that Columbus didn't return home and say, actually, there's nothing much to see out there. I'm glad that Columbus didn't say there's a large piece of real estate, but we should leave it to itself. I'm glad that the people from Europe arrived. I'm glad that this country has been built up by people of all sorts of different backgrounds. I think the American success story relies on these things existing as part of the story of America. And to see everything about it from the beginning to the present day solely in this negative light, I'm afraid if that continues, America will continue to be torn apart. So as you say, I mean, it's not like this belongs to one political side or should belong to one political side. The story of America and the story of the West should belong to everybody who wants to be a part of it.
In March, right after the election of Joe Biden, there was a meeting of officials from the Chinese government with our top State Department officials in Alaska, where the Chinese and Yang Shishi, their foreign representative, the equivalent of their State Department head, lectured all of our people. They said, we believe it is important for the United States to change its own image and to stop advancing its own democracy in the rest of the world. Many people within the United States actually have little confidence in the democracy of the United States. And they cited as reasons for this, you accuse us of being racist and discriminatory and even genocide of the Uyghur Muslims. Well, there's a genocide on your streets, and yes, it's of Black Americans, and you're murdering them with your police forces. And you say that, you know, we are, you know, meddling in the affairs of nations around the world. Well, you meddle in the affairs of nations around the world. And they essentially were approaching this meeting with the aim of utterly degrading our moral authority and using language that, frankly, to me, sounded like Ibram X. Kendi. It sounded like Nicole Hannah-Jones.
Yes.
To what degree, when we confront the war on the West, are we confronting not just the local school board, the local official or bureaucrat or person who has been infected with the mind virus of the 1619 Project? Are we confronting our actual enemies, who would like to see the degradation of the West?
Yes.
And who have invaded us in a way that the Soviet Union never could achieve. There is no Red Dawn about in a movie about the Chinese. You know, there is no equivalent of that.
That's right. Well, as you know, the example I give, as well as the one you just cited, of the Chinese taking advantage of our own self-harm, which is effectively what is going on, is what happened at the United Nations last year around the same time, when the American ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, on one of these UN International Racism Awareness Days, which obviously is one of those days that always does a lot of good, you know, obviously massively practically helpful to everyone in the world. So,
racism, and then we had lunch.
We had a one-day conference to end it. And, this UN conference was addressed by the US ambassador to the UN, who denounced her own country as having been guilty of racism and it being its original sin from the beginning, and said that America was still a racist society. She talked about George Floyd's murder, killing. She talked about the Asian spar incident that had recently happened, which actually turned out to have nothing to do with race. But she presented this, just then, very fresh crime as evidence of further racism in America. So she not only said things that had happened, but she said and cited things that hadn't happened for racist reasons as being yet more evidence of America's ongoing racism. What does she say at the end of her remarks after attacking America throughout most of her speech? She says that it's true that there is racism going on elsewhere in the world today, such as the events in the Xinjiang province of China, where 1 million Uyghur Muslims are held in concentration camps. Well, guess who is up on the floor next? But the Chinese Communist Party's ambassador to the United Nations, who says America has done something exceptional today. Their representative has come to the floor of the United Nations and confessed to their nation's guilt. So America is in no position to lecture us. Well, what a self-harm is there. What a shot in both America's feet. First of all, American representative of the United Nations lies about America, lies that, for instance, the killing of George Floyd is in some way typical of America rather than highly atypical and unusual. And then, after having done so, he's amazed to discover that the countries that have 1 million people in concentration camps at the same moment don't want to listen to America. Why? Because America has just handed them a very easy opt-out. You see, American representatives like Blinken, like Thomas Greenfield, seem to find it very hard to realize that even taking a good and reasonable attitude towards ourselves in the West, anything we have done historically which is bad will be used against us by our competitors and adversaries, always, always. But to invent new reasons to give them is something quite exceptional. Just last week, the China Daily News, which is one of the organs of the Chinese Communist Party, put out a cartoon online of Uncle Sam behind the Oval Office desk, surrounded by corpses, and said, you know, this has always been America, George Floyd, the separation of families at the border. You know, and of course they do this because, again, a new generation of people in the West believe this stuff. People like the Chinese Communist Party, and to a lesser extent, Vladimir Putin's Kremlin, try to take advantage of this narrative of the West within the West. And as a result, a lot of people follow this. And of course, we need to push back against this very straightforwardly. You know, the Chinese Communist Party is not sincerely concerned about racist deaths. It is not remotely concerned about the separation of families. Anyone who thinks otherwise could speak to the Uyghur Muslims if they could get to speak to them.
or to the citizens of Shanghai at the moment.
Shanghai, the citizens of Hong Kong, mm-hmm. which used to be such a terrific and thriving place, and now under the grip of the Chinese Communist Party has become a hellhole.
Your invocation of that Greenfield event, which I banished from my memory, brings to mind the old Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the late great, response to the Soviet Union. Am I embarrassed to speak for a less than perfect democracy? Not one bit. Find me its equal. Mm-hmm. which is quite a contrast. You know, there is this thread that I find so fascinating. I'd like you to enlighten me about it, of modern liberals. And I mean that term truly, not leftists, liberals.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Of which I would include, if I rewind back to 1999, Bill Maher and John Stewart.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
One of these people still seems to have the opinions that he had in 1999, and that's Bill Maher, who has managed to basically rile up everybody by simply expressing the same views of your average ACLU donor in 1999.
Yes, yes.
And contrast that for a moment to me with John Stewart, who has, you know, come back from a time away from television and seems to be prostrating himself in front of the people who've become powerful in the time since.
That's quite right. Yes.
They were both liberals at that time. They were both liberals. Mm. But also people who believed in the American project and in, you know, the project of free speech and in enlightenment values. And yet now they seem to be on opposite ends of the spectrum, certainly politically, certainly in terms of the way that they have approached things. John Stewart was basically reduced to trying to lecture Cory Booker you know, on one of his episodes for why he wasn't fully informed on the racism, the systemic racism of our traffic policies. But tell me about the contrast there. Why did these liberals kind of shoot off in different directions?
That's a very good point and a very interesting question, because you see, I completely agree with you. Obviously, these are two people who started from a similar place and have now ended up in wildly divergent ones. John Stewart in his current Apple series, which is very little watched, it turns out. And surprise, surprise, why would it be? I mean, given that one of the recent episodes was called The Problem with White People. I mean, tune in for a whole hour of masochism. Tune in for an entire hour where Jon Stewart will tell you you're scum. Fantastic. What's not to like? Look, the problem that's happened is like the problem that's happened in all of these other sort of social movements of our time. In The Madness of Crowds, I give the example of, you know, once the trans claim came rocketing towards everyone in recent years, there were people who held their ground and there were people who didn't. And the people who held their ground, you couldn't always predict who they would be. But for instance, you would have left-wing women who said, no, I've fought all my life for women's based rights and I'm not going to give them up now, even if you come at me with, you know, the big bearded man, once he slips into the pool, becomes a woman stuff. You know, even if you do that, I'm not giving in. So you could predict with some accuracy who they would be, but not with complete accuracy, because other people just decided, I want a quiet life. I'll go along with it. There's something complex going on. I don't really have the time to look at it. Sure, whatever, you know. Now, the interesting thing is that clearly, Bill Maher continues to think about these things. He looks very closely at the culture. He has a very good radar and a sense of it. I don't think he would agree with either of our politics in the round.
No.
But he recognized
the. Have you done his show?
I'm going to next month.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent.
You've done it many times, haven't you?
I've done it three times, but you are the perfect guest for that show. Well, so I'm very glad that you're doing it.
Famous last words. But Bill Maher has held on to a particular position. And as you say, it's not as if it's a dogmatic position. It's what I would regard as being a classical liberal, open-minded position. He's certainly not a conservative, but he's certainly not a radical leftist. Jon Stewart appears to have gone into the wilderness and come back completely lost. He looks lost to me. His whole appearance looks like a man who's been badly deflated. Now, I'm afraid...
I mean, this is 40 days in the desert kind of look to him.
Exactly. Doesn't he just? And I'm afraid that people like that. There are some people who, you know, literally the sort of cultural revolution comes at them. They're tired or they're beleaguered or they just don't have the energy and they just say, yeah, okay, whatever I need to say, sure. And it seems to me very sadly, because there was a time when he was a very good comedian, a very good host.
He was at the apex for a moment
And he seems to have gone away, come back, lost his mojo, and just agreed to go along with the current claims. And of course, there are lots of reasons to feel sadness about that, one of which is, you know, there was a good person who's just become another automaton. But another is that, you know, I would say it shows something about your character that you would change like that. You see, if somebody comes along and makes a set of claims, which, you know, you should have the self-respect to interrogate those claims. You know, is what I'm being told actually true? So, for instance, on this recent show, this appalling one about white people, as I mentioned recently, I was actually in Washington over the weekend and saw Andrew Sullivan, who Jon Stewart and the rest of the panel tried to put through a public struggle session, you know, like something from Cambodia during the Cultural Revolution.
I've been recommending Frank Decotter's The Cultural Revolution to everyone who will listen to me for the last two years.
Yes.
It's such an indication of this, but please continue.
Absolutely. Exactly. So, Jon Stewart was desiring clearly to show up Andrew Sullivan as a racist, which is ridiculous. I mean, anyone further from racist, you couldn't imagine, but also the other people on the panel were saying things that were so ridiculous. For instance, there was a woman on the panel who said, and she's the woman who does these fantastical dinners where white women pay thousands of dollars to go to dinner and be told about their racism. Anyway, the woman who runs this racket says at one point, I don't want to listen to any more white men, signaling to Andrew Sullivan, you know, because if white men could solve racism, you've had 400 years to do that, and you haven't. And now, a self-respecting person, a self-respecting thinker, as John Stuart was of old, would have said, what do you mean by that? What do you mean that white people had 400 years, the white men had 400 years to solve racism and haven't, and therefore all white men should shut up now? What is it that white women, for instance, can solve today that white men can't help in solving? What is it that is so bad about white men and what they've done and are now? You know, you would ask very basic questions like that before you allowed somebody to so smugly and dogmatically just whisk away the population. And John Stuart did none of that. And I'm afraid that just demonstrates in my mind, he seems to have lost his critical mind. He's lost his critical faculties. He's decided to bow to the moment. And as a process, we've probably lost him. Well, there we are.
So you obviously are, you know, have written a book that includes much about the left's assault on the West, which I think my listeners are probably quite familiar with. But there is a pincer action here, which you have to acknowledge. There is a strain, they might call themselves common good conservatives. They might describe themselves in different ways. I will admit, Sohrab Ahmari is a good friend of mine. I've gone on vacation with him. We are close. I disagree with many of his positions. He has not taken, to my mind, a position as disgusting as something like Adrian from Mule, who you know, has essentially become a pro-China interlocutor.
Yes, extraordinary.
It's really quite depressing for me to see. There is this faction of the right that basically says, say what you will about the Chinese Communist Party, but they do not have trans twerking library hour, to which I would respond, well, they do have genocide.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
How do we adjudicate that? Because many of these people are people who are, you know, they're intellectuals, they're academics, they're not dumb people, yet they seem to be taken in by this idea that the West has become decadent, that enlightenment values have turned out to be a failure, it's dominated by globalist neoliberalism, and we ought to reject it in favor of either a Putin-esque rediscovery of orthodoxy, which is of course a sham, or that we ought to, you know, have some kind of new, more authoritarian, quote unquote, common good constitutionalism as opposed to originalism.
Yes. I think these are people who are advocating that we take strychnine to cure us of a cold. And I cannot go along with that cure.
No, not so much.
I mean, For instance, I see this on parts of the right, and I recognize it. It does have a historic strain. There has always been a part of the right that says, you know, that laments decadence, and sometimes with understanding, you know, understandable and so on. It can whip itself up into a fever, which is, I think, what some of the people we're describing here are doing. They're whipping themselves up into a fever. And as a result, they make that fatal mistake that things cannot be worse than they are.
But as long as you say things cannot be worse, things can be worse.
And I mean, you know, exactly. I mean, I am put in mind of people like, you know, frankly, and I mean, obviously, I don't mean this in the personal sense anyway against Sohrab, who I much admire and like, but it puts me in mind of the people in the last days of the Shah, who thought you could not have worse than the Shah in Iran.
100%, yes.
You know, it puts me in mind of the people who thought that there was nothing worse than the court at Versailles and had yet to experience the terror. Mm-hmm. It is always the case that there are criticisms to be made within a liberal democracy, because liberal democracies are messy. We are necessarily noisy, and we have to permit things that we do not ourselves want to take part in. That's just the nature of tolerance that the West has gone through and understood since John Locke, at least. We should be able to understand that. We should be able to address the excesses of liberalism and all of that without for a moment thinking that an authoritarian system is therefore the answer. There have been conservatives who've said in recent months, and certainly in recent years, you know, and I think, as you say, it's a complete crock. You know, Vladimir Putin knows which bathroom to use. Well, sure, that's not the only thing of interest. You know,
yeah, other things matter as well.
You know, not invading countries and shelling civilian populations is also an important thing. But what I'm trying to get at is I think there is a form of conservative pessimist that always exists. They're not always wrong, but the where they go wrong is when they think that because liberalism has excesses, the answer is totalitarianism. Chinese totalitarianism, you know, I always say, if you dislike the era of American hegemony, you're going to love the era of Chinese communist hegemony.
No, I just want to interject. That's one of the best lines that you have had, like just in terms of clarifying the situation. If you didn't like an era in which we were in charge, try the era in which they are in charge.
Yeah. And Ben, as you know, younger people in particular, which I'm thinking college age students and so on, don't have the perspective on that.
No, they assume the existence is the natural order of things.
Exactly. And you see it. And in this situation, that needs rectifying by adults. And this is, in a way, what comes back to the John Stuart thing is are you willing to give in to the struggle session? Are you willing to give in to the mob of the moment? Or are you willing to say, now, look here, Sonny, let me tell you something about the world. Effectively, you know, we have in our society in the West a dearth of adults willing to say, now, look, I accept the fact that you have run up debt being indoctrinated at a liberal arts college and you think you know everything about the world, but I'm X age now and let me tell you some things about the world. we have run out of the people willing to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to do that. You know, it's very interesting in history there are periods where only the old are thought to know anything. Pre-First World War Vienna, for instance. Only the older thought had to want to know anything, and the younger thought not effectively have very much to contribute. They have to get old before they can. That's kind of off as a society, as a social vision, because new ideas are needed and young people come up with new ideas. So I don't want to in any way dismiss young people and their potential, but this is a dialogue that has to happen, not a sermon. Not a lecture, let alone a lecture from the young to the old about how they think the world is. It requires adults to say, look, I'm going to tell you, for instance, that, I mean, I'm going to tell you what it looked like in the 1980s and 90s in relation to, say, racism in America. You know, we saw that there was some, but my God, you know, the leading entertainers, there were leading figures in every walk of American life who were Black. So don't tell me that there's never been Black representation in American life, or that, you know, we've been kind of hiding parts of our past. You know, the people who say we haven't had any of these debates before, you know, just turn around and say, I'm sorry, we've had them all my life. Mm-hmm. We've had them all my life. America has been having this debate for 200 years. Britain's been having this debate for 200 years. Don't get born yesterday and then tell me what I remember. Mm-hmm. You know, we need that in our society.
As Craig Ferguson said, you know, when you prize youth above all things, that's how you get the freaking Jonas Brothers. So I want to you've been very generous with your time, but I want to close out with this. I detect within both our governmental authorities, our media authorities, our business authorities, woke, corporate, and all of that, a tendency towards something dangerous. And I would say, reflecting back on the politicians, you know, you have Bill Clinton, who is essentially, you know, like Bill Maher, like Jon Stewart, a 90s liberal, an ACLU type, you know, sort of person, someone who still believed in America. I've come from a place called hope. To the little seeds that kind of crept through in the Obama years, you know, people clinging to their guns and their Bibles. The first time I'm proud of this country, you know, from Michelle. There's that little creeping kind of sign. And now it seems like this dominant corporatist, leftist, anti-enlightenment persuasion is adopting an approach that you might pull from Bertolt Brecht. Would it not, in that case, be simpler for the government to dissolve the people and elect another?
Yes.
They just want all these people to go away.
Yes.
go away as quickly as possible. And yes. And that to me is, how do you share a country with a movement like that, that seems to be much more sizable than I ever thought it was? I thought it was, I will admit, I thought it was 10%. I thought it was, you know, the fringe of the political movement, but it now seems to not just be a significant portion of American life, but a significant portion of one of its major parties.
I think that's right. And I think the answer lies, as you say, Ben, in the fact that I think we're right to assume that although there's more of those people, the radicals, effectively the anti-Western, anti-American side, than we might like to have thought, nevertheless, they still are not a majority. And you know, I've written, as you know, about the madness of crowds, but there can also be a thing called the wisdom of crowds, where elites and political operatives and people who are surrounded in this all the time go stampeding forward with a new theory, and they roll it out as they have done with things like CRT in America. And they roll these things out. And actually what's required at that point is the wisdom of crowds, the wisdom of the majority. And I actually think that we are seeing that in America. The parents movement, the movement of, you know, American parents who just said, I just found out what you're trying to indoctrinate my kid with, and I'm not having it. Now, those are the people
Bosh.
Who give me hope. Exactly. These are the people who should give us all hope. And as I say at the end of The War on the West, part of my purpose of writing the book is to give these people the armory they need to win this argument, the specific things they need to be able to know, and the bigger general arguments they need to level back. Because as I say, when an elite goes running off and dominates your institutions and all sorts of terrifyingly large number of government institutions and education institutions and all of that, you cannot rely on a single politician to come and save you. It is at that point reliant on the American people and the people of the West to save themselves and to say, no, this is what we have. We like it. We'd like to keep it. And we will explain to you why you are wrong and why we would like to continue our mode of life, because it's good. And as I always say, but it's a very important point to make, that we all know this to be true. Why do we know it? Because the footfall proves it. America remains the number one country of destination of choice of people around the world fleeing economic deprivation, social deprivation, warfare, and much more. If America is the most desired destination now, here is a thing, and the American people know this still in their heart. It's the number one desired destination of people in the world because America is good now. And there's a follow-on point. if America is good now, it's because it has also been good in the past. You must have done something right in America to get what we have now. So focus on that. Don't be told to forget that. And remember that you don't have to go along with the mob.
Douglas Murray, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
It's a huge pleasure. Thank you.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast right after this. So it's been an interesting time in Washington because of this incredible leak that has occurred from the Supreme Court. It's really unprecedented. It's amazing to see in front of us. The kind of fallout from it can only begin to be estimated in terms of how much it undermines the court and the position that the court has had within our government. Certainly, it's something that is concerning to me for a variety of reasons. It's going to change the nature of the Supreme Court, make it more partisan when it was really the last of our three branches of government at the federal level to avoid partisanship and to still have friendships and relationships that cut across the political grain. Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia were famously close friends. This is a situation that is unfortunate for a lot of different reasons. And I think that you can see some tea leaves in what the motivation was for the leak in this follow-up article that came out from the Washington Post over the weekend. It detailed, based on a number of sources close to conservative members of the court, as they identified them, who said that the original five-vote majority in favor of upholding the Mississippi law in question and striking down Roe has held, that basically the wavering Chief Justice may be off writing his own decision individually, something that would be more narrow, uphold the Mississippi law, but not strike down Roe or Casey, but he seems to be doing that on his own, which seems to indicate that the leaker, whoever it was, whether they were at the court, a clerk, or whether they were someone adjacent to the court, was certainly trying to attempt to intimidate create a warning and potentially protest atmosphere around the whole decision, perhaps trying to make one of the justices waver. They have failed in that attempt, apparently. And we will know when the decision ultimately comes down within the next several weeks or perhaps the next couple of months. This is a situation that ought to have been avoided and can only do damage to the court. But it's going to lead to an investigation. We may never know who actually did this. But at the end of the day, these decisions are some of the most closely held and protected documents, when they're going through this opinion process that you see in the government. They are supposed to only be read within the court building. They're shredded twice and then burned in a burn bag. They're meant to be something that is closely held because there is so much that can change between the time you begin writing an opinion and what ends up coming out. And they don't want you to see all of the different processes and debates that go back and forth along the way. They want to speak at the end with one voice solidly in an opinion that the Supreme Court can hold up as supreme. This is something, though, that's very interesting to me because so much of the anger that is coming from the left on this issue is due to the fact that they are essentially going to have to revert back to 1972 and make the case politically for their views, as opposed to leaning on a court that has short-circuited the democratic and representative process. Why are they so afraid of that? It's so odd to listen to the people who are saying certain things on TV about Americans' views on abortion. On the one hand, they emphasize overwhelmingly Americans are in favor of keeping Roe in place and keeping quote-unquote abortion rights, a term that I reject as being false, as something that is protected. And yet on the flip side, they say, well, when you get rid of Roe, all of this is going to go away overnight, and it is going to sweep across the land, and we could end up with a national regime that punishes women for miscarriages, rips birth control off of the shelves, bans condoms and the pill, and ultimately leads to banning interracial marriage, which is something that Joe Biden actually claimed in a total lie to the American people. Clarence Thomas obviously is in an interracial marriage. But this is also a circumstance where I think you have to understand what's really going on here. The left is engaging in these tactics because they are afraid of what comes next. There are, at this moment, across the country, 37 states where the Senate, the House, and the governorship are all possessed by one party. In those states, the decision about what happens when it comes to abortion policy will essentially be a decision made by the Democratic Party of the state or the Republican Party of the state, depending on who controls it. In only 13 states will this dispute be between parties. And so what that means is you're going to have a range of results because of Roe that looks more like what people in these various states want abortion policy to be. In California, in New York, it's going to be Roe, or perhaps even more extreme, more funding, even wider allowances for abortion. In states like Mississippi or Oklahoma, it's going to be very restricted. You're going to see potentially total bans or very early weak bans on these kinds of things. And yet for most states, you're going to end up with a circumstance that has a wide range of outcomes from 10 weeks to 20 weeks to 25 weeks, to 30. And that's the kind of thing that, ultimately would have been the result had Roe never existed. It would have allowed the states to come to their own conclusions. And if people didn't like that, then they could go to a different state. But that's just the way it works. We assume that states will exercise this kind of authority in so many different areas of life. But in this one, it was torn away from them by the court, who invented a right that did not exist and was not in the Constitution. Now we are experiencing the results of that. But if the left really is so confident that the American people are on their side on this issue, they sure seem to be acting like they're concerned that the opposite is true. They're worried that they're going to finally have to make the case for their abortion maximalist agenda to the American people at a moment when they may be doubting the efficacy and the appropriateness and the moral authority of that case. That's the reason that they have leaned so hard on the Roe issue, creating a false narrative where basically the choice was between maintaining Roe or a Taliban-like theocracy of punishment for women. That was never the truth. And we're going to learn in the coming months how much that was a departure from the way that the American people can govern themselves. Trusting the people is not a mistake. It allows them to adjudicate these issues closest to them, which is where they belong. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another episode of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.